Hi, folks. I'm Dakota Cohen. Thank you so much for checking out the Building Your Homestead podcast, where I talk with expert guests about agriculture, health, economics, technology, philosophy, and other topics that I believe will help us to peacefully exit the increasing tyranny of our world and start building a parallel system, one homestead at a time. Ben, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Dude, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Okay. So today I want to get into Bitcoin and the Lightning Network. And the reason is many homesteaders are overwhelmed by the challenge of how to make secure, anonymous, permissionless, uncomplicated, and affordable financial transactions in the ever-growing parallel economy. So my goal here is to highlight a real-world example about how Bitcoin and Lightning Network is providing a beautiful solution to all the myriad problems that we all see popping up increasingly in our current financial monetary system. So, Ben, you've been educating people in the realm of Bitcoin since 2016 on your YouTube channel. In between tutorials, you're regularly traveling the globe, speaking at conferences, running workshops, educating political dissidents on how to use Bitcoin as a tool for human rights. And you've also recently spearheaded a Bitcoin-only market in Calgary, in my home province of Alberta, or our home province of Alberta. You've got a ton of links for all the websites, the YouTube, your socials. It's all in the links below, or the description below. But Ben, to start off with, can you give me your elevator pitch for a new one, a newbie to Bitcoin? What is it? And then share a bit about what got you interested in it yourself back in 2014.
Yeah, so Bitcoin is a solution to the broken money that we see today. It's effectively a way of having a money that no other man or woman can print. And it's a way of being able to transact freely from peer to peer with nobody that is able to tell you no in between. So it is censorship resistant, decentralized, sound money.
Wow. Okay. And so, we're going to dive into a bit more about why that's important. But so yeah, what was it back in 2014? Like, why were you looking for something that was, censorship resistance? No one could tell you no. Why not just use the paper money in your wallet then?
So, my initial interest came from a mix of a couple things. There's a saying in Bitcoin, people come for number, go up, and then they stay for the revolution. Mm-hmm. And that was very much my trajectory as well. So, I wouldn't say I was a super technical person, but I used to have a little bit of a side hustle where I would buy a used MacBook and swap out the hard drive or something like that and, upgrade it a little bit and then go and sell it. And so because of that, I was on websites like TechCrunch and some of the other technical ones. And every once in a while, a Bitcoin article would pop up and cross my purview. And that happened a lot through 2013 because it was on a bit of a tear. And it went from double-digit prices from, $13, $14, $15 a coin to that year. By the end of the year, it was up to $1,200. So there were a number of times where I saw an article and Bitcoin's at $20 or $35 or Bitcoin's at $200. And so each time I saw those things flash up, I'd go, huh, that's interesting. And well, I guess I missed the boat. That kind of mentality of, we can only go up so much. And so seeing it go from, double digits to $1,200 inside of a calendar year was pretty wild. And so it prompted me to dig a bit deeper. My thoughts were either this is a giant Ponzi scheme or there's something here. And I didn't get any Bitcoin right away. I actually spent a couple months trying to read and understand what the hell it even was. Then I started poking around and trying to figure out how wallets and all these different things worked, where to get Bitcoin. And it was a gradual shift. Bitcoin was a pretty good teacher for me. And one of the first teaching moments was shortly after having bought it, there was an exchange out of Japan called Mt. Gox that collapsed.
Oh, no, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and this is one of the early, you know, big FUD articles of Bitcoin was, this functionally was a business that was holding other people's Bitcoin for them that lost everybody's money or was hacked and, you know, or stole the funds or whatever. And I saw those news stories pop up, and the story that they were telling was very different. It was that Bitcoin got hacked and were broken in some way. And I knew this wasn't the case. And so it was my first taste of the news doesn't always know what they're talking about.
Okay.
The first moment of, if I know this, if I know how this works after, you know, a couple months of digging into it, and the news is presenting this as absolute fact to me, what other items might I assume they know what they're talking about that they just don't? Or you know, what possible stories could I be misinformed on when watching the news? So it was informative in that way, that, you know, just because it's on the news doesn't mean it's necessarily true. But yeah, gradually over time, I came to I came from what I would say would be a in terms of a monetary sense, my own thoughts in and around money were very left leaning and progressive, and they moved a lot more conservative, like fiscal conservatism. I got into the crux of what is money, how does money function, and what happens when there's too much of it, and how is it even created? All of those things, I began to learn those throughout my foray into Bitcoin, and how Bitcoin removes those powers, those abilities of anybody to print money out of thin air. And so that was kind of my trajectory in my early learning. I came in because, as a lot of people, they see dollar signs in their eyes as they see this number going up, and then soon enough, you no longer want the dollars.
Totally. Okay, so you touched on a few things there, and I want to dig into some of the problems of our current financial system. So kind of the same question is, if you were to give someone an elevator pitch for why, you know, the dollars in your wallet, or the pieces of paper in your wallet aren't actually yours, how do you start to, you know, use simple analogies to essentially orange people, as we call it in the community now, to wake people up to just how corrupt our current system is?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a surprising number of people believe, or up until very recently believed, that our money was still backed by gold. And this hasn't been the case for ages. Yeah. Yeah. Right. They thought somehow some type of precious metal is backing our currency. This hasn't been the case quite overtly since 1971. But even before then, that peg was loose at best. And there's been times where that's fluctuated. But I guess looking at how things previously were, it would be, you know, X number of units in our economy, you know, $20 for every $20 that existed in the US, those $20 would be backed by 1 ounce of gold. And so what ended up happening was at some point, the US government decided, well, we can't really have this anymore. We need the ability to have an elastic money supply. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to confiscate all of the gold. So they went in, and this was possible partly because of the physicality of gold is oftentimes the ownership of said gold will be centralized, or rather people will entrust others to secure their gold. Yeah. And so it would be in bank vaults, and we would abstract it out by representing it with paper notes as that was the case. And sometimes people would, you know, have physical gold in their homes, but nonetheless, they did something called Executive Order 6102, where they confiscated obviously all the gold in the vaults. But then also there was massive fines for owning Bitcoin, or not Bitcoin, but massive fines for owning gold. And so they had the populace turn in their gold at a rate of around $20 per ounce. 1 year later, they announced that they were going to devalue the currency, or that the currency would now be, for every 1 ounce of gold, there would be $35 of currency floating around. So effectively what they did is they took everybody's gold and then they said, here's $20 in exchange for an ounce. And then 1 year later, they said, all right, we're those dollars that we gave you in exchange for your gold, well, effectively now there's double the amount as when we originally paid you out. So they stole half of the money, or half of the purchasing power, from all those people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we went on with that gold standard for a while. Gold ownership was illegal in the United States up until the 70s. The U.S. still stored a lot of gold for other countries. And it wasn't until in the 70s and late 60s that countries started wanting to repatriate their gold that problem started. And this was because countries started to recognize, geez, these guys have been fighting a war in Vietnam for quite some time. It's really curious how they have enough money to do this, given that the US dollar is pegged $35 to an ounce of gold. So it's very clear that they were printing more dollars than gold. And so countries started to say, well, I'm gonna need to exchange these dollars back to the gold that you're holding for us. And France even sent a warship over to collect its gold. And shortly thereafter, Nixon went on the TV and said that the speculators were going to ruin the U.S. dollar, and he's temporarily suspending convertibility, which turned into a forever thing.
Yeah.
So that kind of outlines, you know, part of the problem with our existing money is that when you have an abstraction of something actually sound, it's very easy for a governing body to kind of rug pull that peg. And now we're just sitting in an instance where there's no bound on the amount of dollars that can be created. The crazy thing is, a lot of people, you get no financial education throughout the school system, myself included. And so you come out the other end of that not knowing how literally one half of every transaction functions. Like you don't know how that system even works. And I think the best way to explain it is, you can't create value by creating money, right? The value is created when people do productive things or create goods or services that people desire. And you have more value in economy as we get better at creating things with less effort. Yeah. And so, you know, at any given time right now, there's only so many items. There's only so many things you can buy. There's only so many services you can obtain on the entire globe based on how productive humanity is.
Yeah.
And the amount of dollars floating around is just a measuring stick for what percentage of all those goods and services you personally can afford. Mm. And the problem with the money printing is, if you were to look at your bank account and instead of showing you the arbitrary number of dollars that you hold, it showed you what percentage of the economy do you own.
Yes.
That number would continually go down.
Yeah.
Continually, because somebody else is printing more dollars and your percentage of the total economy is disappearing. And it was a big, big, I'm going to say it was downright malicious what was done during the lockdowns when we were getting sent out checks, because people, they printed 40% of all existing currency inside of a year and a half or 2 years. And they sent out checks to people. And you felt that you had more because the arbitrary number in your bank account said you did. But as a whole, the purchasing power of what you had was less. You as a person had a lower percentage of the entire economy because out of all the money printed, sure, you got some breadcrumbs here, but where do you think the bulk of it went? Wherever the government deemed, well, we find value in this. And so it, in a way, it was erasing the economic impact of every individual's economic decisions from day to day. You expect that when you pour your blood, sweat, and tears into working hard every day and you get remunerated in a money, and then you go forth and you use that economic power to purchase things and use services, you expect the values that you hold to in part be reflected back at you by society. But when the government can press a button and undo on all of that economic impact,
yeah,
there's a reason why people are angry but don't know why, because their values are not being reflected at back at them because they're being erased at the push of a button. And society is not reflecting where they're putting their blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah, absolutely. Another way I've heard it explained that really landed for me was if printing money actually solved problems, then why does the government also tax its citizens?
Yeah. There's no like, if there was no downside to printing money, why would they ever need to collect taxes? They just create some more money.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. It's very, very deceptive. It is indeed a hidden tax because there's no, you know, when you collect taxes, at least it's overt. And a person, you know, everybody looks at their paycheck and goes, wow, the government is really raking me over the coals on this one. But that's on top of the deceptive hidden tax of inflation.
Yeah. And I was looking at the official inflation numbers for Canada the last few years for a project we're working on. And I think it was in 2022, it was the official rates was almost 7%. Like the officially acknowledged on the Government of Canada website was 7%. So another way of framing that is the government stole 7% of your wealth that year.
Yeah. And think of what that does. Think of what that also does in terms of the behavior, like let alone those numbers are massively.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, like the way that
the fuel and
Yeah, let's omit all of the important things that people actually want. And on top of that, they'll swap out. So a funny thing is, let's say, so these numbers, these inflation numbers aren't pegged to standard of living, right? What they're doing is they're looking at what is the average Canadian spending money on. And so if you used to be able to afford to get steak once a week, and then all of a sudden you are hurting. And so you swap that out for, you end up swapping that out for some ground beef. And then maybe eventually you're swapping it out for, you're just buying like ramen noodles. Yeah. They're going to, the way they interpret that is, nobody's buying steak anymore. I guess it's not useful to measure measure that. So we're going to swap it in for a like. So typically this would happen with, lots of people were buying steak, but now more Canadians are buying ground beef. So we're going to swap that in as a similar good and now calculate inflation numbers based on that. So it's like it has no bearing on the fact that these people's standard of living have dropped. And thus, the new measure doesn't incorporate the fact that steak is now way more expensive and out of reach for the average person.
Exactly. Well, and then the other fact of that too is the we know that they printed whatever 40% of the dollars that are in existence in that short period of time, and yet their official inflation rates are only 6%. Yeah. So the spread is just massive on that.
Yeah, and the other thing too is inflation is not uniform, right? Because when people do have additional capital, if they have additional dollars. They're not going to spend that uniformly, particularly when they recognize that holding dollars is not a good idea to store wealth. Mm-hmm. So where does a lot of that flow into? It flows into anything that people perceive as being able to store value over long term. So look at the speculative nature of real estate now.
Exactly.
Right. Yes. It's no longer just you buy a home to have a home. It's what have you been told? It's your most important investment. Yes. Investment is the vernacular used to describe. And how much more did the idea of investment properties proliferate? There's a reason that homes are being treated that way now. It's been necessitated by the money itself, because the money is no longer a store of value. And you are forced to speculate to have a hope of making it to any type of retirement. So either it's speculation on real estate, speculation in the stock market, you know, handing your money over to a money manager and just hoping that they, you know, I'll pay you fees. Hopefully I make it. You know, this is the nature of the game now.
Yeah, it is. And it's wild. Like I just got an agricultural magazine in my mail the other day, and it was praising the increase in land value in the last year, kind of looking at it year over year. And in 1 year, the land value in certain parts of Alberta went up over 20%.
Yeah.
And they were this whole article was written as, isn't that fantastic? This is why, you know, how you can work this into your strategy and your portfolio. And it's like, the land is not worth any more money. Your money's worth less. And and that's why the nominal value of land's gone up.
Yeah. It's very deceptive. The way that everything kind of plays out, and it's hard to articulate, and most people don't go beyond the idea or actually do the mental calculation of how much purchasing power have I actually gained. Because if you're in a neighborhood and everybody's house goes up 20%, did anybody actually make money?
No. okay. So I think that was a great breakdown of like one of the core problem of our current financial system and how that's affecting literally every human being on this planet. Like the ability for someone else to decide, like if you're playing a game of Monopoly and a banker gets to decide how much extra money he gets and certain, you know, players in the game get, like you would not play that game. You would say, fuck it and flip it over and go do something else. And I think that's massive, but I don't think people realize just with the complexity and how much propaganda is being spit at people for like the price gouging and like these private corporations or the monopolies, like all these other just absolute red herrings that are being pumped out by you know, by statists. The people aren't realizing that what the core problem actually is, which it is the government. They're the only one who can legally counterfeit money. And so enter Bitcoin. How is Bitcoin helping everyday people all over the world to play a new game of Monopoly that's actually fair?
Yeah. So Bitcoin is a system in which there is a fixed supply of Bitcoin that will ever be created. And upon inception, that was laid out as to how it was going to function. So when Bitcoin started, every 10 minutes, 50 new coins were created. And that number gets cut in half every 4 years. So that's to say that the supply of new coins coming onto the market gets cut in half every 4 years. This has happened. It happened in 2012, 16, 20, and it's about to happen again in very short order here in and around April 20th of 2024. So roughly every 4 years this happens. And so for the first time ever with this halving, the inflation rate of Bitcoin will be going below that of gold. So the amount of gold being mined,
that's right.
Is at a higher inflation rate for the monetary base than Bitcoin will be for the first time.
Wow.
And so Bitcoin's very unique in its monetary properties, in that it's actually the scarcest thing that humanity has ever seen. And what I mean is, typically in a free market, what happens is when there is excessive demand for something, people find a way to create more of it. So again, we'll use gold mining as an example, even though it is indeed finite in supply on Earth. When gold is at a certain price, doesn't make economic sense to dig for gold in certain areas or to dig deep enough or turn on certain equipment. It doesn't make economic sense. But if the price of gold pumps, then certain mining operations become profitable. And so, yes, we'll dig deeper. We'll use more expensive equipment. We'll find other ways to obtain gold. It begins to make sense. And so you get a slight increase into the incoming supply of newly mined gold. And so the reason gold has historically been used for money is because it's been the most resistant to that, right? There's just only so much gold. It's only so accessible. So it kind of kept it below that 2% influx of new supply every year. With Bitcoin, no matter how much demand there is no increasing the issuance of Bitcoin at any given time. It is absolutely set in stone that this much Bitcoin comes into existence every 10 minutes, and it doesn't matter if tomorrow the entire planet decided we all want a little bit of Bitcoin. There will be no increase to the speed at which Bitcoin is able to be issued. It will still happen at roughly the same cadence. And so it's truly resistant to supply shocks and demand shocks in both directions. Okay. Yeah. So
And so spell that out a little bit more in terms of like, what are the implications of that in terms of governments, day-to-day life for people? Like, what does that mean that no matter how much demand there is for it, there will never be more?
Yeah.
Like, how does that change the game theory of?
Yeah. So there's a few implications here. Number one, for the first time, and this is due in part to some of the other properties of Bitcoin and in and around it being censorship resistant and decentralized and unable to be shut down effectively. For the first time, you've got a global currency that that now requires central bankers to compete with your average person deciding which currency they would like to use. Of course, there's states can try and have their top down control in and around that, and of course they try to do that through the on and off ramps. But at its base layer, Bitcoin stands as a potential competitor to all other forms of money, and it is the most scarce out of all of them. And when that cannot be shut down, the game theory begins to play out. So number one, we talked about the financialization of things that we would normally just use day to day, like our homes. So those things, when your money's broken and homes become a mechanism to store your wealth, then speculation abounds and homes become expensive, and you actually end up pricing out people that actually just wanted the home for its purpose. And that really screws the society. When you have a money that you can simply earn and save, and because of the virtue of, one, our population continues to increase, we have scarce resources here, but we also get better at creating stuff with less effort, you have this natural deflation to your purchasing power. So you can just be good at a thing. You can provide value to others, earn money, spend less than you earn, and save for the future. And your retirement is just taken care of because you put in the effort earlier, you delayed gratification, and you can then benefit from that later in life. It's not to say people always go down the deflation argument of, well, if people know their money's going to be worth more later, they're never going to spend it. That's fully not true. And the reason you know that's not true is you always know that a new cell phone's going to be cheaper in 2 years. The same cell phone's going to be cheaper in 2 years.
Exactly, yeah.
Have you ever just not bought a cell phone or a TV or a computer? Like technology is the perfect example of how people still spend money. You're still going to have things that you would like to have, but it does make you more conscious of what you'd like to purchase. So I'm not going to pick up some trinkety plastic bullshit that's going to break and then go buy it again and buy it again. You know what I'm going to do instead? And what I've started doing is, now that I perceive my money as actually having value and will have more value in the future, I'm going to actually opt for items that I'm going to be able to keep in my family for generations. I'm going to go to my friend who's a carpenter and have him carve me a solid oak table that weighs 400 pounds. And that thing's going to sit in my house until it burns to the ground. Or, you know, I'm going to hire my friend to do good handiwork and, you know, finish my basement and make it nice and perfect so that it will last forever. I'm not going to buy crappy products, because if I spend sound money on you and you give me an inferior product, you're not going to retain me beyond the initial sale. No. And so what it does is it makes people more responsible with their own money, but it has a secondary effect where when people are more responsible and conscious about where they're spending their money, it requires producers of products and services to be so much better in what they produce, because you need to convince people to part with their money. So everybody benefits, because if you save, it's going to be worth more in the future. You'd be able to get more stuff. If you spend, people are making better products in order to convince you to send. So society as a whole just begins to improve.
Exactly. And there's one other aspect that I want to touch on, particularly for you know, my audience, which is in the homesteading and kind of regenerative agriculture space, which is people who have an incentive to save for the future and look forward to it are also not going to pollute their environment and erode topsoil and, you know, throw garbage out there. All these things that our governments for years have been trying to, you know, regulate and fine and find, you know, subtle ways to basically nudge people to do the right thing. All that just goes away because people become inherently self-interested in making sure that they're not shitting in their own bed.
And I
just think that was one of the piece when I got that of how, you know, essentially what we're talking about is the concept of time preference, which I've gone into in other podcasts. That piece, it just shifted everything for me. Yeah. And you realize we don't need, these governments passing all these safety regulations and forcing people to do the right thing. People will do the right thing on their own.
As long as they're incentivized to do so.
Exactly. I mean,
it's all the incentive structure. If the incentives lead you to make poor short-term decisions, because how do you plan for the future when your money is going to be obsolete over time, or when your purchasing power just disappears, when there's no certainty? If you don't have certainty of what you're going to be able to buy in a year, how do people expect to act in accordance with something that's going to benefit from them a decade from now or two decades? You can't plan for the future.
No. And this gets really bad in societies where, you know, hyperinflation comes into play. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's heard stories about, you know, Venezuela, where it hit 2000%. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was in Cuba, but my late brother used to work there, and he said every payday that night, all the grocery stores were empty night. Mm-hmm. And the reason was because everyone just got really hungry that day. It was because they knew that as your money is basically decreasing in value every day, you try to buy anything that you can speculate on. And if you can't afford a house, you'll buy rice or a 45-gallon drum of, you know, vegetable oil or toothpaste or whatever it is, because those things actually have value and are going to, you know, the next day, the value of your dollar will be worth less, but that toothbrush that you bought a dozen of, you can now trade that for someone else for the remainder of the month while your money keeps crashing. And that's when shit just gets crazy and governments start to pass speculation laws and they blame it on the businessmen and the price gougers. Mm-hmm. And then they bring out, you know, universal basic income and all these subsidies. And it just snowballs it into the ground.
It's such again, that extreme, shows directionally what broken money does to a society. And what I mean is the reason that, you know, having a system where you abstract away value into a denomination that you can freely trade as like a good that can be universal and represents everything in the economy. The reason we can abstract away that is because that value is expected to hold. And on the other extreme end of that, when that value doesn't hold, you know, the point of money was so that you didn't have to deal with a barter society where you require a coincidence of wants in order to successfully transact. Look what happens when it degrades. You literally just described people going from a monetary standard degrading back down into barter because the currency ceases to work.
Yeah, exactly. And it also had ramifications on morality. Mm-hmm. And you know, my brother talked a lot about this, about how like you couldn't trust anybody in Cuba because and he didn't, at that time I wasn't aware of inflation and, you know, the Cantillon effect and all these other things, but now it's so clear to see why in a society that is literally incentivizing people who, the closer you get to the money printer, the more benefit you have.
Yeah.
And the less time you spend on you know, trying to create things of value, or the more time you spend creating things of value that or for longevity, like your oak table, for example, people aren't going to be able to afford that. So it starts to incentivize everyone to make cheap crap that is just you're only thinking a day ahead. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes to the point where, you know, if like, why do the right thing? Like what's the point with anything? Like workers,
we're seeing this a lot, right?
Exactly. But it was so much more extreme in Cuba, where they would literally steal the knobs and buttons off of equipment at his workplace, because they would get paid 25 cents a day or whatever it was, or 25 cents an hour. And it just crushed my brother to see, you know, people like this. But that was in late stage, you know, hyperinflation. But we're starting to see that, like, as you said, here day to day with crime rates are growing up.
Yeah, I mean, people are disillusioned in their job. I mean, I'm sure everybody's felt it. You go into a store or something, nobody cares. Nobody cares to do anything. And it's because they feel taken advantage of, right? They feel, you know, when you're in a system where your dollar doesn't hold its value, you got to think about what's actually happening there. Somebody entered into an employment contract with the understanding that I value my time, or we've come to an agreement that an hour of my time is worth the following amount of dollars. And at the time of that contract, you have in your head a general idea of what an hour of your time will then purchase. Yeah. Well, that contract is almost immediately reneged upon, not for the fault of the employer, but because the denomination that you're sitting in, that measuring stick is broken, and it measures nothing because it's fluctuating. And so you get into a situation where now you're getting TikToks of nurses sitting in their cars crying because they can't afford groceries. And 10 years ago, they're saying this was a good career. This was meant to be like a respected, high earning career, and I can't afford rent. And they don't understand why that is. And so you got to think right now in an inflationary system, it does put everything from the top down instead of bottom up. And I'm going to kind of compare what we're like in an inflationary monetary environment versus, say, mild deflation.
Yeah.
So So yeah, you enter into an employment contract, you say I'm worth this many dollars an hour, you know, a year later, 2 years later, you're beginning not to afford your rent. What do you have to do? You have to go to your employer and you have to then beg and barter with them and say like, hey, I deserve a raise. I deserve to maintain my standard of living. That's what I deserve. You have to argue to maintain your standard of living. And it's, again, not the fault of the employer necessarily, because they're required or they are simply trying to run the most profitable business possible. All of their expenses have gone up as well. Salaries are just kind of like a constant where, yeah, if somebody comes forward, it becomes a bit of a balancing act. You know, is it going to be worth it? All that kind of stuff. But the power is with whoever is the next level up. Flip that for a second. Imagine there was a money where rather than a gradual decrease in purchasing power, there was a gradual increase in purchasing power. You enter into an employment contract, say I'm worth this amount of money per hour. And over time, next year, exact same pay, you can afford a little bit more. Next year, exact same pay, you can afford a little bit more. Now, luckily, because of human ingenuity, you're also able to produce a little bit more. You're able to accomplish a little bit more. The tools get a little bit easier. So you're also providing more value to the company or to your employer. If you're using those tools and you're not providing more value, then it falls to the employer. The impetus is on them to come to you and say, here's why we believe that a pay cut is in order. And they don't have to just grapple with that. They have to grapple with the ideas. If they perceive that and they go to you and say, here's why we think we need to cut your pay, and you say, well, I quit, they then have to do the mental math of, okay, is that going to be worth it to replace the person? Yeah. And so the power lies with the blue collar worker in that instance, rather than people above them. So it's a complete role reversal.
Wow. I've never thought of that. That's such a, oh man, you know, one of the sayings in Bitcoin is, you know, fix the money, fix the world. And the more I get into it, it's like literally every problem that I've identified thus far, whether it's, you know, human rights or pollution or, you know, government corruption, like everything comes back to if someone can't arbitrarily print money and decide who gets it, the level field, the game of is level, and people play totally differently, and people actually will, people become better people as a result of this. It's just,
you're incentivized too.
Okay, so I think that was fantastic in terms of like contrasting the pros and cons of the fiat money system to a hard money system like Bitcoin. The next piece I want to talk about is why Bitcoin, not crypto?
That's a great question. And actually, the segue is kind of perfect, because we've just outlined why being able to print money is so negatively impactful on a society. Yeah. So the best comparison or the best analogy that I can always think of here is fiat currencies like the dollar. Fiat currencies mean that the elites can print money. That creates a whole host of problems, right? They can enrich themselves and their friends, and the people furthest down the line are the most disenfranchised. Yeah. And it causes, you know, you to have no idea what the purchasing power of your money is, and that measuring stick is broken. So fiat, the elites can print money. Crypto, everyone can print money. Everyone can print money. And and if you watch it, you'll see this is exactly what happens. There's people that are printing new tokens. They're keeping a portion for themselves. They're able to create more. They're able to assign it to whoever they want. They're able to enrich their friends. But it's like a hot potato. You're hopping from one to the other. And oh, who am I going to get in on this one when it pumps before it dumps? And there's all these insider information, all kinds of crazy corruption. It is fiat on cocaine. That's what crypto is. Fiat is the elites can print money. Crypto is everyone can print money. Bitcoin is no one can print money. No one has any say over how much Bitcoin is created, over where it's allocated. If you want Bitcoin, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to purchase it from somebody, or another way of saying is you're going to offer a good or service to accept it. You're going to maybe, if somebody will take them, exchange your dollars for Bitcoin. We're still at a stage where that's possible. maybe not in the future. And then finally, you may become a Bitcoin miner. And that's another way where you can obtain Bitcoin, where I say a certain amount of Bitcoin is created every 10 minutes. Miners effectively confirm transactions and secure the network and make it so that your transactions cannot be reversed. They make it so that it's prohibitively expensive for somebody to try and screw with a transaction or take back their money or whatever. But they perform a service for the Bitcoin network, and they're rewarded by currently newly created Bitcoin, but also Bitcoin transaction fees that are attached each time you send money. So no one can print money out of nothing. If you're a Bitcoin miner, you are expending capital and energy in order to do that, and you're rewarded for that service. But you're not allowed to just print arbitrarily money with for zero cost. There's a real cost to it. And if you the neat thing about Bitcoin mining is there's a set of rules to the protocol. And some of those rules are things like there's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin. And, you know, there's certain circumstances in which Bitcoin can be sent, and data amounts that can be used. There's a set of rules that you basically opt into when you use Bitcoin. If a miner goes and tries to subvert those rules and attach transactions that aren't valid, that maybe create money out of nothing, first of all, the entire network sees that and says that's not valid. But that miner just expended a lot of capital and energy to do that. So they go and they say, we're going to print some money. Number one, it is impossible for that to work. Number two, they just lost all of the energy and all of the money they piled into the resources in order to mine Bitcoin. So it's prohibitively expensive and ineffective for them to try and print money.
Yeah, absolutely. So just tying that back a bit more to some more of the nuance between, like, for example, the second biggest cryptocurrency in the world right now is Ethereum.
Yes.
One of the things that differentiates them is that there's no set amount for how much ETH there will be.
Yeah.
They can arbitrarily change it up or down. They can create them or burn them whenever they want. But what other, what are some of the other, beyond just printing money, what are some of the other kind of downfalls of some of these other cryptocurrencies that differentiate them from Bitcoin?
So, the main thing that Bitcoin has to offer is censorship resistance. The assurance that your transaction is irreversible, or rather, the degree of certainty that you have that your transaction will never be reversed. And then, of course, the sound money aspect of it. The main selling feature of Bitcoin is how certain you are of the rules. You know, you're opting into a system, you're using a money, you want to be certain that those rules are sound, that it's a strong foundation, it's not going to be shaken. A lot of other, outside of the monetary properties, like you said, Ethereum doesn't have a cap. They've changed monetary policy multiple times, so on and so forth. But all of that harkens back to how certain am I of the rules of the system?
Yeah.
And Bitcoin has a very conservative approach. And unless there's broad consensus on a change, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
With Ethereum and most other coins, effectively, I mean, the rule set changes all the time. Ethereum changes. Ethereum has changed many, many times. I remember, and this was back a few years ago, but I was working at an online exchange, and the online exchange needs to be privy to any changes in all of the coins that they deal with. And this is before I was, had come to the realization of Bitcoin only. Yeah. And so Ethereum made some huge change, non-backwards compatible change, where everybody had to update at the same time.
Yeah.
And then they forgot to upgrade something, and, you know, which was kind of breaking the network at the time. And yeah. So they did this sweeping change to the entire network. It appeared to have worked okay. Oh, crap, we forgot something. We need to make another sweeping change. And this was like over Christmas holidays. And they had to make another, it's called a fork, another hard fork, a non-backwards compatible change inside of 2 weeks. So that tells me something. Number one, it tells me that the underlying rule set that governs Ethereum is entirely malleable. You have no idea how it's going to function today versus 6 months from now or a year from now. Number two, it tells me that it's not decentralized. And why does it tell me that? Because you actually need consensus to do those things. You need people that are running the protocol to all change simultaneously when it's not backwards compatible. This is called running a node. In Bitcoin, you can run a node. It's basically a copy of the rules and a copy of the history of transactions. If there is something that changes in Bitcoin that's not backwards compatible, every person running a node needs to update at the same time. With Ethereum, they managed to have non-backwards compatible changes twice in 2 weeks. So that tells me that nobody's running a node. Nobody's running the infrastructure. It's very centralized in a few entities and a bunch of cloud servers, and nobody's doing it independently. And so that means that that's why it's so easy to change, because it's not decentralized. So I mean, those are some of the things. Also in the history of Ethereum, and I know I'm picking on Ethereum right now, but it's across the board, you're going to get flavors of this where, there was a hack that happened in one of the contracts and they effectively froze everything and then reversed it.
Yeah.
So like you don't have certainty of transaction reversals. And even just from back to a monetary policy perspective, out the gate when it launched, it launched and they said, all right, we're going to price Ethereum at a certain amount of Bitcoin. If you want Ethereum, we're doing a pre-sale. You can purchase Ethereum at the following price. We're going to sell 30% of it, and then we're going to keep 70% of it. It was a 70%. They kept 70% of, I'm going to say the equity, because basically this is an unregistered security. They kept 70% of it for the Ethereum Foundation, which is now under investigation from the SEC.
Yeah.
And I don't say that in from the perspective of I love the SEC, but I say that from the perspective of there's an actual door to knock on. There's a centralized group of people that can pull strings, and thus they get their doors knocked on. And with Bitcoin, there's no CEO, there's nobody to go to. It just is. So that's kind of the crux of it.
Yeah. That's great. And like I'd heard before, like the litmus test of like of when you're trying to look at the validity of a coin, one is like, was there a pre-mine?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a CEO? Yeah. And I like the one that you just brought up there, which is like, and how sure are you of what the rules are? Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, it's like if you were going to a casino or something and you were going to bet on, you know, one of the games or, you know, play a slot or whatever it is, you would never put money on the table unless you knew what the rules of the game were.
Yeah.
But if the dealer or the house could just decide, you know, arbitrarily, oh, yeah, suddenly these are the rules. Oh, you didn't know? Sorry.
Yeah.
That money's all right. You would never play that game. And yet people are literally investing, you know, thousands of dollars into or more. Like what, like I actually don't know what the numbers are. What percentage of what's the total value of in the Ethereum pool versus Bitcoin?
Let me see here. I'm going to take a quick peek. So right now the market cap of Bitcoin is almost $1.4 trillion.
Yeah.
The market cap of Ethereum is around 430 billion. So it's large. It's not near as large as Bitcoin, like a third.
It's like a third of.
Yeah, I'd say about a third, a little bit less than a third.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting part is market cap is actually not exactly a useful metric, because when you think of it, at the current market price of Ethereum, they could tomorrow decide to double the supply.
Yeah.
Or say, let's say quadruple the supply. And if they did that at the current market price, technically speaking, they now have a larger market cap than Bitcoin. But what's going to be the per token price, right? And so, like, and how did that affect individual holders of the currency and everything? And so it's always important that you zoom out and you look at the price in Bitcoin. And there's going to be times where these things spike quicker than Bitcoin does. But in reality, when you look at pretty much across the board, other than maybe like a new thing that's yet to get its initial pump, owning anything other than Bitcoin is a volatile path to owning less Bitcoin. you might be up for a little bit, but eventually you're going to be down.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay, so that was fantastic. I think now I'd like to venture into a bit more about the Lightning Network.
Yeah.
And then talking about this new market that you've created in Calgary. Mm-hmm. To segue into that, one of the biggest criticisms of Bitcoin is that, you know, it's too slow or it's too expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, you're never gonna you can't afford to buy your daily coffee or your groceries with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the network was designed. And it can take over an hour to verify, you know, simple on-chain payments. So enter Lightning Network. What is that? And how is that helping small businesses and consumers and kind of playing into this whole conversation that we've started around the getting away from the fiat money system and creating a parallel one?
Yeah. So Lightning Network, without getting too technical about it, it's effectively a layer on top of Bitcoin that allows for instant transactions and much cheaper transactions. And okay. So this allows you to basically route payments not abstracted away. So it's not like a token representing Bitcoin. It is actual locked up Bitcoin between two people, say between me and you.
Yeah.
And it functions as a line of liquidity between us, meaning, you know, if I open a what's known as a lightning channel to you, you can picture it like beads on an abacus where you can slide them back and forth. And you can think of this in terms of a tab. You're a business. I frequent your business. I have a lightning channel to you. Okay, well, how does that work in practice? Well, if I open the lightning channel, all the funds are going to be here on my side. But maybe you're a bar and every time I buy a beer, I'm going to make a payment and I'm going to bump little transactions, little bits of Bitcoin over to your side of the channel. And so at the end of that engagement, at the end of the night, I've had X number of beers and we can settle up and we can close that channel.
Yeah.
Now, you can take that same concept. And again, the whole time that Bitcoin is actually locked in what's known as a multi-sig between us. Basically, we have two keys and it's like the nuclear codes. We both have to turn the key. But if somebody's being shady, you can, you know, with the latest state of who owns what, you can close the channel. But nonetheless, the idea is it's between the two of us. Functionally, how the Lightning Network works is, I'm not just going to have a channel with you. I'm going to have a channel with maybe somebody else. And you're going to have a channel with somebody else and maybe many other people that frequent your establishment. But you're going to have probably a few different channels to other businesses, so on and so forth. And so in practice, what's happening is you're getting these lightning nodes that have many different connections. And I cannot just pay you, but I can pay other people that you're connected to and other people that they're connected to. So in that abacus example where I bump a payment towards you, Maybe I'm not meaning to pay you. I'm meaning to pay somebody that's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon away. Right. So I bump it, you bump it, and it goes boom, 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 boom down the line and hits a final recipient. Yeah. All of this is done instantaneously for very minuscule fees in comparison to Bitcoin, which settles every 10 minutes roughly. And the fees are dependent on how busy the network is. With Lightning, it's not dependent on that at all.
Yeah. Okay. And so let's back up a bit and can you explain why is it so essential that Bitcoin is slow and it is expensive?
Yeah. So this is to ensure that everybody's state of the ledger of who owns what is consistent. If you had instantaneous payments, basically everybody needs to update their ledger at the exact same time. And so it happens at a cadence of 10 minutes. This gives plenty of time for the data of all of the transactions that have happened over the past 10 minutes to be aggregated and then proliferated out to all of the people that are running what's known as a Bitcoin node. And so basically we take blocks of transactions, you put them all together, you place them there. And then when this is what miners do, they'll say, okay, this is the updated ledger of who owns what. These are all the changes. And then they blast that out and it starts bumping across to all these nodes in the network. Everybody's saying, okay, this looks valid. No invalid transactions or anything. Everything is all good. Update, update, update. And you see it start to boom, 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 boom across the globe. Everybody gets a state of who owns what. So part of it is, yeah, you can't have instant transactions because the order in which things happen is very important. A lot of people refer to the Bitcoin blockchain as the time chain because it actually has a sequence in which things happen. If there was no sequence, then I could spend money to somebody and then they could spend money to somebody else and all the way down the line. And if I then broadcast simultaneously a different transaction where I spent to somebody else, neither of those are settled yet. One of them will actually settle and one of them will be invalid because I didn't actually have the funds at that point.
Yeah.
So if it happens instantaneously and everybody's already transacting based on the transaction that I did, and then it turns out that this was the one that ends up settling, all of that daisy chain of transactions become invalid and nobody actually received the money. So the cadence at which things are confirmed is actually very important in order to make sure we all have the state of the same ledger. The other important thing in and around why Bitcoin is limited in how much data it can relay over a certain period of time, every 10 minutes, is because people running Bitcoin nodes, the ability to verify the rules and the state of who owns what needs to remain accessible to the average person. Because if you can't verify the rules yourself, then and only large data centers can verify and enforce the rules. Well, that sounds a whole lot like the centralized entities that are banks and central banks. They get to set the rules. Exactly. And so as soon as you lose that ability, Bitcoin is no longer what it once was. And so, you know, you can see there's a little light on my shelf behind me right there. That's a Bitcoin node. It's a tiny little, a couple hundred bucks. And it's just a little computer running some code, and I can take a little copy and paste, and I can direct my wallets to that and say, hey, there's my copy of the Bitcoin blockchain. Check if I have money through that thing. Anytime I want to send a transaction, send it through that thing or receive it through that thing so that it verifies that anything I receive adheres to the rule of the network.
Totally. Yeah. I want to stress what you said there, which is like if it wasn't, you know, that slow and expensive to validate these things, it would be no different than a central bank running the same thing. And so, like, if you go into the bank account or you write two checks, for example, because that's the double spend problem. You could write $2,000 checks to two different people when you only have $1,000 in your bank account, and whoever catches them first is the one who's going to get it. But in our current system, there's an intermediary in there who will step in if you do something bad and punish you and fine you and make everything right.
Yeah.
But with that centralization, and security comes the downsides of, well, now the government can decide, you know, whether they can seize your bank accounts and all these other things. So yeah, this is the brilliant aspect of Bitcoin, is that it is totally decentralized. You know, you're running it on $100. You have a central bank for $100 in your own home that you're running.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if you'd like this, but is there any chance you'd want me to show a Lightning transaction, how fast and cheap it is?
Yeah, let's do it.
I can do that if I'm allowed to share my. I'll sec here.
I think so. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll do that one, and then whenever you're ready, you can pop it up. Awesome. Okay, so basically what I've got here is I've got a Lightning wallet. This is actually my phone just plugged into my computer, so you can see what's on my phone right now. And then I've got another Lightning wallet here in my browser. And so I'm going to send a small amount of Bitcoin. That's going to be like 7 cents, just to kind of show, like, you can send tiny amounts. So I'm going to, in my one wallet for my phone, I'm going to hit receive, and then I'm going to create an invoice for 100 sats. So that's about 6 cents US. And I'm going to say create invoice. So that gives me a little QR code. Anybody could scan that and pay it. Or there's a little copy button, and clicking that will copy just a string of text. Okay. That's all somebody needs to be able to pay me. I'm going to now, in this other Lightning wallet, hit send, and I'm going to paste in that string of text and hit continue. It says, hey, this is an invoice for 100 sats. It's around 6 or 7 cents. Do you want to pay it? I'll hit pay, and then it will go off. There we go. And it was instant. And I basically, I don't even know if I paid a fee on that. Let's find out what I paid.
What was the fee?
The fee, I don't think I had a fee there. It might have been 1 sat. It was very little.
Okay, yeah, it was like a fraction of a fraction of a penny.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is fascinating, because as a small business owner myself, if I were to try to do that with, say, MasterCard or Visa or any credit, that would cost me at least 30 cents per transaction plus 3 to 5% per transaction fee.
Yeah.
And all the other, you know, programs I got to buy on top of it to sync my books and everything else.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be that fast.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty wild. And again, with Bitcoin, like right now, we're at a point as Bitcoin begins to scale in different ways, there's going to be different tools for different jobs. And so the unique thing about, like, Lightning is more, it's well suited for day-to-day transactions, maybe even a few $100 here and there, $1,000, something like that. When you're moving meaningful, like large amounts of money, it may be better suited to use a regular Bitcoin transaction, not Lightning. And the reason for that is with Lightning, if you're sending large amounts, then it has to do with how, you know, the Lightning network is all based on liquidity. You're locking up Bitcoin between two people. And so when you go and you drain a channel all the way, there might be a fee that relates to the amount that you're sending.
Yeah.
When you're sending a regular Bitcoin transaction, the fee has nothing to do with the amount you're sending. It has to do with data, because that's the scarce resource. Everybody has to host it on their node and everything. You get in an instance where, you know, if a transaction might cost you a $2 fee on as a regular Bitcoin transaction, it would be irrelevant how much you were sending. So it would make sense to buy a coffee and pay a $2 fee, but you could also send $1 billion and pay a $2 fee. So it's like, you know, you just recognize the tools for the job, but like Bitcoin just opens up this entire thing where you can go, I can be as efficient as I need to be.
Exactly. And so, and this is a shitty analogy. Maybe you've got a better one. It's like if Bitcoin was, you know, like a gold bar that you were sending via like an armored carrier at the speed of light anywhere on the planet, like that's going to be really expensive, but it's guaranteed it's going to get there.
Yeah.
And then the Lightning is just like, it's like you said, it's that abacus. That's like a tab between you and your friends. Is that like a fair?
Yeah. Yeah. Like Lightning is, currently right now, you would think of a Lightning wallet like the one that I had up there as kind of your day-to-day spending money. This is what, you know, and we'll touch on it a little bit with the market thing, but this is like, you know, you go down and you buy a nice steak from your local market, or you go buy a a t-shirt or a coffee or something like that. That's kind of, you know, the Lightning Network of today is its main purpose. Whereas, you know, a regular Bitcoin transaction for me is maybe I'm moving, you know, at the end of the month, whatever is going into savings, I'm going to move that as a regular Bitcoin transaction.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And now I think this is a great segue into the sat or day market that you created in Calgary. So let's actually, I've got a quote from the market page, which is, I'm assuming this is your voice. You said, I've been living on Bitcoin since 2020 and love the idea of being completely self-sovereign with the fruits of my labor. If there's anything we've learned in Canada over the past couple of years, it's that the money in your bank account isn't really yours. So from that kind of, you know, statement there, let's segue into why did you create the Saturday market? Yeah. What is a Saturday market? And then what's your vision for it going forward?
Yeah. So I began to recognize that, you know, I think the powers that be won't particularly be fans of this, of course. And we've seen that in other countries. China effectively banned Bitcoin and everything. We'll maybe touch on what that resulted in later. But governments are going to like it. So how do you prevent yourself from being caught up in that? What are they going to do to prevent you from using it? Well, the easiest things for them to do is go to the on and off ramps, go to the exchanges and say, all right, you're not allowed to sell people Bitcoin anymore. You're not allowed to have these abilities for people to take their dollars and purchase Bitcoin anymore. We were going to cut that off. Okay. Yeah. So then you now have an instance where, okay, if you want to get into and out of Bitcoin, you're going to have to use a decentralized or peer-to-peer method of getting it, right? You're going to have to find somebody local or somebody remote where you can get matched with a person and exchange dollars for Bitcoin through some sort of a peer-to-peer market. Those things do exist. Mm-hmm. Of course, they can always try to block them in certain jurisdictions. You can get around with VPNs and all that, but you know, it's going to be a pain in the butt. In what world does it become easy? It becomes easy when you just use Bitcoin day to day. And I'm not talking about using it through a service. I'm talking about you meet your local rancher, you meet your barber, you know, your plumber, you have an egg guy, you know, like you do all of these things and you're able to locally source everything that you need with like-minded people who understand the values of sound money and low time preference and, you know, creating meaningful relationships in the community. It becomes exceedingly difficult for people to say, hey, I know you two know each other and I know you have eggs and you have Bitcoin. Don't you dare, when I leave here, switch some eggs for some sats. Don't go doing that. That is impossible to continue to enforce for any extended period of time. And so the idea behind what we call the sat market or the sat per day market, because, you know, the smallest denomination of a Bitcoin is a sat, is that we wanted to create a local circular Bitcoin economy where people can function on a money that actually holds its value and hold all of ourselves to a higher standard of the quality of products that we're providing to each other, because we know each other, we value each other's services, and we remunerate each other for our services in money that actually has value. And so the first one we did was back in December, on very short notice, actually about 3 weeks, because I saw a bunch of people bitching about, oh, they're trying to enforce rules on all these exchanges and everything, but nobody was proposing doing anything about it. And so I kind of got fed up and I said, let's stop bitching and actually do something about it. And the only way you can actually do something about it is just stop using dollars, get out of that system. I'm not saying that it's super easy. I'm not saying it's not going to take work, But like, that's part of the thing with low time preference. Let's build this thing and make ourselves resilient to that top down pressure. Because when you create a community and you just know each other, that's something that can't be stopped, in my belief. And this is the way forward, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to highlight, you know, what you've done with the Saturday Market. And I've had another guest on the podcast as well to highlight Bitcoin, is because, like, in the homesteading space, you know, one of the kind of mantras is that homesteading, or it's a revolution disguised as homesteading. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that you were saying at the beginning of the podcast, that you know you came into Bitcoin originally for the number go up kind of dollar signs in your eyes, but then you stayed for the revolutionary aspect of it. And I can't stress that enough, of just how powerful of a tool money is for the powers that shouldn't be to control us. And the fact that for the first time in history, we have that tool at our disposal, and it's faster, better, cheaper than what they're doing. Like, you know, before, everyone's seen, you know, the movies with revolutionaries and how, like, the black market, how dangerous and inefficient, and the mafia is, like, it was just a rat's nest. Like, we have no excuses whatsoever now to not exit the current system and start building it, you know, day by day, like you're saying. And I had the opportunity to be at the first market. There was a second one just this past weekend that I couldn't make it to, but there's another one that you're going to be doing in, it's July 1st,
okay. Canada Day.
Okay.
It's going to be just south of Calgary at the Saskatoon Berry Farm. Okay. And this one's going to be, I think it's going to be a pretty good one. I think it's going to have a far larger base of people attending it, far more merchants. They've been super awesome about it. The people down at the farm, about having this idea, they're super keen on Bitcoin. They're ready to learn. We're going to be tapping in hopefully to a whole bunch of new merchants for the first time that are just getting they're just learning about Bitcoin. And we want it to be accessible to the average person as well, right? Yeah. We want any person to be able to come in there because it is market. And so I think our tactic is that we want every merchant to have the capability of accepting Bitcoin. So we're going to teach them how to do that, how to set up a wallet, how to you know, do transactions, which it's not too much of a hurdle to overcome. Download an app, you know, write down a few words and you're good to go.
Yeah.
We're also going to say, absolutely, come, you can use cash. All of the Bitcoin merchants will also happily take cash. And the reason for that is so that we can expose new people to the idea of Bitcoin. We're also going to say, any of the merchants that are curious but maybe don't yet want to keep the Bitcoin, that's totally fine. If you want, at the end of the day, we will have people there that are more than happy to swap out from your Bitcoin to cash. And so we're trying to make it as accessible as possible. But the important thing is that it's all Bitcoin friendly, and that we can begin to educate people. We're also going to have an area with education resources where you can just come up and say, hey, I've never used this before. How do I get started? And we will show you, and we'll set you up with a wallet. And then, you know, if you want, you can go and, you know, use some cash to get some Bitcoin, or vice versa. And we'll help facilitate all of that. So if you're not a Bitcoiner yet, don't worry about it. Still come down, even if you just want to bring cash and just kind of peek around, that's totally fine. But if you do want to learn, we're happy to help.
Fantastic. So where can, if you're a, you know, a consumer, or if you're a merchant, where can people find out more about the upcoming market in July?
Yeah, so a couple places. Number one, if you can, I think you have the link. We have a meetup group. So you can go in and join. It's my meetup group, but that's where we're going to be first and foremost announcing and allowing people to find the event. Also, you can check out my website, btcsessions.ca. And there'll be news on there in the events page as that comes to fruition. So we don't have it formally announced yet, but it is coming. But the meetup group and that, if you want to be a merchant, you can reach out to the co-organizer. His name is Dave Bradley, but he can be reached at dave@bitcoinbrains.com, and I'll give you that.
All the details will be in the show notes below.
As a merchant, just reach out to Dave and we'll start getting things rolling with that. We've got another great guy that's helping us named Art that's going to be doing some of that too. The meetup page, the website, my website with the events page, and then reach out to Dave.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm going to be there for our farm, building your homestead's also going to have a booth there. We're going to be, you know, showing people our latest designs and various service offerings that we're constantly growing all the time too. So I hope as many people as possible can come. And this is also coinciding with another event that you've been putting on for a couple of years. So tell us a bit more about Bitcoin Rodeo.
Yeah. So this is going to be happening. So the market will be the day before the Bitcoin Rodeo. And this is a 2-day Bitcoin conference that's going to be in downtown Calgary at the Grand Theater. Okay. We are getting a bunch of speakers are flying in to speak at this thing. People that have been around the Bitcoin space that are great educators, great thinkers in the space. We're also having, for those familiar, there's an awesome comedian out of Texas named JP Sears, and he's a hilarious guy. He's big into Bitcoin too, so he's coming up. He's going to be doing a few nights. He's doing a few nights at the Laugh Shop, but then he's coming to the Bitcoin Rodeo, and he's got a Bitcoin comedy set that he's going to do.
No way.
Yeah. But there's going to be a whole bunch of people. So that's going to happen on the 2nd and 3rd of July, the day after the market. And you can go to bitcoinrodeo.com for tickets for that. And it should be a really good time. I think the early bird tickets are still on for the next little bit. And then when those go, it'll be regular price.
Absolutely. Yeah. My colleague and I were at the one last year. It was an awesome time. I can't imagine how big this one's going to be. It's going to be sweet. So
it's going to be cool. Great. I think it's primed for some pretty good attendance. And I think I'm quite excited to be a part of it and to build up this local community, because it is, there's a swell.
Yeah. And you really are the one who's making the waves in Alberta, as far as I can see. So thank you so much for doing that. Cause this is really, as I said before, like this is a massive missing piece in our ability to exit the current system. And the fact that all the pieces are there, and like, literally if you can do online banking, you can use Bitcoin. It's that simple now.
Yeah. If you can download an app,
yeah,
you're good.
Yeah. Okay, Ben. So to wrap up, I want to ask you about what have you noticed? You've spent the last, you know, over 10 years engaged in Bitcoin, and since 2020, you say you've been living entirely on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. How has that changed your life for the better?
Yeah. Well, I mean, number one, when I'm going to say that it's changed it in just about every way. Number one, obviously I'm better off in that I actually learned better fiscal responsibility. When you live in a system where your money is worth less and less and less, you become disillusioned, become bad at saving. I never was a good saver before Bitcoin. I had no idea how to keep it. You know, everything was burning a hole in my pocket. And I've learned a lot of bad habits. I had no idea how money worked, nothing. And so it improved my ability to, again, the kind of the three tenets that I go by: provide value to others, spend less than you earn, save in money that nobody can print. And so if you do those three things, then again, financially, you're going to be far better off. But it extends beyond that, because once you kind of understand the value of low time preference, or another way of putting it, of not having such a desire to have immediate gratification, that you can delay gratification, you begin to see the virtue of that, and you begin to apply some of those lessons to some of the other parts of your life when it comes to health and nutrition and being fit and going to the gym and, you know, seeing what you consume. You begin to apply it to your relationships. You begin to apply it to a lot of other aspects of life. And I'm not saying that Bitcoin makes you perfect, but it does make you think a little bit more deeper about, you know, some of your habits and maybe start to shift them. And so I found that it's had a profound effect on how I handle my life and my relationships and my health.
Yeah. And it's also, it's given me a, like your point about, it doesn't make you perfect, but it's helped make me realize why other people are the way they are. Like, everyone, like the guy at the grocery store who just, you know, could care less, and the poor quality of everything. And even the politicians, like just the corruption at every level. It's like, oh, everyone is just trying to get by in a totally rigged system. And it's the amount of patience and compassion it's given me for fellow human beings has been enormous. Yeah.
Couldn't agree more.
If you could go back in time, you know, just before, you know, you learned about Bitcoin for the first time back in, I think it was 2014, and you just had a few minutes to tell yourself something, you know, about what you've learned on the journey thus far, and not just buy more Bitcoin. What would you tell yourself if you only had, say, you know, a minute before you got sucked back into the vortex?
I would say, and I'm trying to think how to accurately encapsulate this. I would say that your goals are closer than you think. Achieving your goals are closer. It's a closer, it's not as difficult as you think. You just need to actually act. I had this presupposition that just everything was always out of reach, you know, even when it came to running the YouTube channel and wanting to do that full time. Yeah. I just assumed not possible. I ended up hiring somebody to kind of, as a bit of a business coach, I suppose, but you know, it didn't take very long for that person to say, okay, well, what's your goal? Well, I want to replace my salary and be able to just, you know, run my own business. Okay, great. What ways can you earn revenue? And then I was able to be shown, okay, well, if that's how you earn revenue, you need X number of clients at the following price, and that replaces your salary. And the other thing was, you don't need everyone to say yes. You just need that number. Make a list, start making calls, and go and do it. And lo and behold, 2 months later, I replaced my salary.
Wow.
So it's the one piece of advice would be just try, because when you assume that you can't do it, or you assume it's going to be harder than it is, well, you don't know until you try, and then you're going to be on a path there, and you're going to be closer than if you hadn't started.
Oh. Okay. Final question. Other than Bitcoin, what gives you hope despite the crazy times that we're living in?
Family, you know, my kids are, you know, they're growing up in a world, and of course, I suppose in a way this relates to Bitcoin, but they're growing up in a world where they'll never know that a solution to our problems didn't exist. The solution has been around since before they were born. Wow. Right? Whereas we grew up where there's a lot of nihilism, because the solution, everybody knew something was broken, but there's no solution in sight. And that's why I see in Bitcoiners, they recognize that, you know, there's hope here. This is hope. There's a way out. There's a system that can run in parallel, and we can just simply hop over to it. And what gives me hope is that people are building solutions, and it's not just Bitcoin. It's other parallel technologies. It's the rise of things like yourself, the homesteading, the being self-sufficient, the being questioning of top-down forces and people telling us what to think. It's this reinvigorated, we're gonna build it ourselves, and we're not gonna trust, we're gonna verify. That mentality, I think, is going to finally allow us to navigate a world in which we're still grappling with the fact that the internet exists and there's so much information everywhere. I think people are beginning, we're at the initial innings of people being able to parse through that information and actually come to good conclusions from it. And I think that's going to be a great thing.
Yeah. What a fantastic place to end. Yeah. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for all that you do. All the links for everything that we talked about are going to be in the show notes below. Please check those out. And in particular, there's also going to be a link there for Ben's kind of, basically starters a tutorial list mm-hmm. on his website, where if you're absolutely new to Bitcoin, you can go there and I think the way you put it, it walks you through every single step of the process. And you make it so easy that, I'm pretty sure even my grandparents could do it. So
that's great. Well, I'm glad.
Okay, Ben, thanks so much, man. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you gained some actionable insights from this podcast about how you can fight the powers that shouldn't be by building your own homestead. If you did, please take the time to share this episode and click all those buttons to like, rate, and follow. This helps spread our message, it makes sure that you never miss an episode, and it sends a middle finger to globalists like Klaus Schwab. I also suggest that you sign up to my newsletters directly on my websites that are in the show notes. With the Government of Canada recently passing Bill C-11, the Online Streaming Act, the threat of me being censored or removed from mainstream media platforms like this one is becoming a reality. If that time ever comes, we can stay connected. Thanks again for listening, and take care until next time.